begun to digest, and we're not even certain what happened, other than to know that it looks like that our nation just is started a new chapter in issues between people about life and death. And I appreciated what I have read of the what is the possible decision of the Supreme Court, and you know, I think it was a good reading of the Constitution. And I appreciated the fact that they said that this is actually just putting the decision back to the states. It's not outlawing anything. But as you can see from street demonstrations and other things like that, as I tried to describe earlier, the anger and various other things going on in people, you should see this as a wound of the soul. These are people who feel threatened, who feel this is dangerous, who feel like this is going to disrupt lives and be difficult. And it's, I think the hardest thing is that a Christian ethic, if we can say something like that, the true Christian ethic believes in asking people to suffer, that goodness does not come without suffering, that greater love has no one than this, Jesus says, that a man lay down his life for his friends. True life, true goodness, true love is cruciform. It follows the shape of the cross. The greatest revelation we have of God is Christ on the cross. Scripture says the Lamb was slain before the foundation of the earth, which is a great mystery. But the image in which we are created isn't just some sort of image of God. It's the image of Christ crucified, which is why Paul can say, I've determined to know among you only Christ and him crucified. This is not a narrowing of the gospel. This is the gospel in its fullness. When we see Jesus crucified, we see the greatest display of the revelation of the love of God possible. And so it's a difficult thing for me as a Christian in which in a culture driven by pleasure and consumerism to talk about an ethic that's based in love that is a suffering love. Someone will say, you know, but you're asking this person to be celibate rather than practice what they want to do sexually. And that is, I'm asking them to suffer. And I think, yes, I'm asking them to suffer. You're married. You know, I always tell people, forgive me, but that when it comes down to marriage, I can only sleep with one more woman than a monk can. Right? And as far as the other 5 billion women in the world, I'm a monk. My wife told me so, you know, and I have to know what a monk knows. And people who have some idea that it's all about, you know, I'm married now, I've got a license to do that, I'm thinking, you haven't been married, have you? It doesn't work like that. But, you know, but the world doesn't know that laying down your life is actually how you find your life. Jesus said it. He who seeks to save his life will lose it. He who seeks to lose his life will save it. And so that if you're counseling with a young woman who's struggling because she's pregnant in difficult circumstances, in my last Episcopal church, we were next door to the local high school, and someone in the high school came to talk to us. They wanted to have an education. Well, they wanted a program to take care of the children of unwed mothers at the high school so the mothers could finish school. I thought, this is a great idea. And so we had a building standing there with all the facilities and nothing going on during the week. And we started a program together with the city schools. And we housed it. And we had an agreement in which we had mutual veto power. And my veto power was, I do not want to have a system that will reward people for an abortion. Like, we had part of our board on this was made up of women who were members of the League of Women Voters, which is very lefty in my town. And they were, God bless them, they were probably all Methodists. They were all do-gooders, you know? And Methodists are real great do-gooding people. And they wanted to have a rule put in place that if one of the girls got pregnant again, they would be booted out of the program. And I said to them, you know, you don't realize just how racist you really are, do you? I said, did you know that most of these young black girls who are getting pregnant, that those are planned pregnancies? Like, you wouldn't think that a girl would plan a pregnancy out of wedlock, but over half of all black conceptions at that time in American culture were out of wedlock. I just said, you got your ideas and they got theirs. I said, we only have one goal in this program, and that is to help these girls finish high school. Then they have some more choices, like what to do with a high school degree. But we don't have to try to figure out how to make them better girls or how to keep them from having sex or anything like that. That's just not our problem. We don't need to solve those things. And so I was the veto power to say no, because basically they were saying, if you'll abort this child, you can stay in the program and take care of your other child. You see how that works? Subtle things in the system, you know? That was a kind of true systemic racism. We want you to be good middle-class white girls. They didn't even think about that. But it was really good, because if you play that card, liberals just fall apart. they can't defend themselves. They think they're bad racists, then you just play it and do it. Anyway, you defend life on that basis. It was wonderful. When I was in North Carolina at Duke, I was very involved in the pro-life program, and we had this black woman, a Baptist, who was about as pro-life as you got, very articulate, and she would go and testify in front of the state legislature, and those guys would just melt. They couldn't say anything to her. She was wonderful. But being pro-life, though, is asking someone to suffer. You know, and when people say you're asking someone to suffer, don't argue with them. But I would also say that I can say to someone, I used to say this to the young women in the program, because they allow me ever so often to give talks, was that the conception of a child in every possible circumstance, you know, is itself a miracle and is a gift from God, even in the worst of circumstances. And I'm very sorry about the terrible circumstances, but it's not the child's fault. And it's a gift from God. And if you may have to give the child for adoption if you decide that's there, but giving birth to a child is always a wonderful and gifted thing and will be a blessing for you in your life. Now, as a priest, and I've over the years counseled with women who have, you know, it comes back. You have an abortion at 18 because the circumstances are impossible. But at 35, you give birth to a child, and the whole time you're carrying this child, you think about the other one. I know it. I've heard it so many times. You're a mother. You're wired for this. You can't just, politics will not argue a child out of the womb. Your conscience won't argue it out of the womb. And so as Christians, we are followers of the crucified Christ, and we preach a gospel that in union with the crucifixion of Christ is how we find the fullness of our humanity. And so we need young men and young women who are being nurtured and becoming adults, and for the rest of us as well. And that means learning to bear a cross, because that's, you know, my dad was part of that greatest generation, you know. Golly gee, I read a lot about him. I just finished rereading the book Band of Brothers. And, you know, what those guys did, some of them, you're 18 years old and you're sloshing up Normandy or sitting in Baston and all of these things. And, you know, they did it. It's just kind of how it's done. And there's a different D-Day in our culture. And yes, we ask people to do hard things. And we don't do anybody a favor by trying to make it, to make the suffering go away. What we do is, and this is one way to describe the church needs to be the kind of community in which people can find the support to deal with the suffering in their life. The church does not exist to remove suffering from the world. Ultimately, those who want to that's the problem of the modern ethic. The modern ethic is to relieve suffering. Ultimately, those who want to relieve suffering will always come down to killing you. It's the only way to keep you from suffering is to kill you or to kill somebody. And that's how it always comes down. You're old,
you're tired, somebody's changing your diapers, let's just kill you. You don't want to be a burden, do you? And I'm thinking, yes, I do. Yes, I do. I've been putting up with their crap for a lot of years. They can put up with mine. Okay? I mean, yes, I do. I want to live my life to the fullest, if that includes babbling like an idiot at the end. God help us. I babbled as a baby. I'll babble as an old man. It's getting there a lot quicker. So, in these earlier talks, I've described our culture as one driven by the passions of all these various sorts. In this last talk, I'm going to focus on several aspects of that, including how you get past it, how we work to begin to live an authentic human life. How do we become what God intends for us to be? The word passion, as you might notice, is related to the word passive. They both have the same root. It's something to bear in mind in that it describes what is true of all the passions. When we speak, for instance, of lust, gluttony, greed, sloth, wrath, envy, pride, these various lists of passions, we're not really describing things that are the direct result of decisions we have made. We're in fact very passive when it comes to the passions. It's much more like these things happen to us. I mean, you don't really, guys, forgive me, I don't know this much about girls, but guys, you don't sort of think, I want to lust some. It just doesn't quite happen that way. She just walks by, and it happens to you. You know, and you think a lot of things. But anyway, you know, I've heard these things by rumor. Of course, these never happened to me. But, you know, the passions happen to us. They are, in fact, reactive. But I want to explain something. We have some myths around all of this. There's a myth in our culture. And I would call it the myth of the modern man, the myth of the modern person. And that myth is that we are all very independent, unique individuals who are defined by the choices and decisions we make. Just say no, right? These are choices and decisions. Choose life, you know, and all this stuff, we're there. This way. This is how we imagine us. So not only do we imagine that, we imagine at its most extreme that we create ourselves, that we're the sum total of our choices and decisions, and that I'm kind of creating myself as I go, like you had that much freedom. You know, I was born, you know, a poor white boy in the South with this accent. I tried to get rid of it, but it comes back, especially as I tell stories. And one of my daughters recently actually listened to a YouTube of a talk I was doing. She says, I didn't realize Papa's accent was that thick. And I thought, it is. There's some words I don't say. My native dialect was a very strong version of Appalachian. My mama did not describe things as being ruined. They were rent. Rent rhymes with burnt. I remember as a high schooler opening up the pantry door and looking in, and I saw a can of Vienna sausages, right? Those little wieners, Vienna sausage. And I had never actually read a can of Vienna sausage, but I read the name on it, and I shouted out to my mother, "Oh my God, they're Vienna sausage." And she said, "What?" I said, "The Vieners, Mama." They're like, and I'm thinking, I can't believe I might have said that word in polite society. That we were eating some Wiener sausages, because that's all I'd ever heard them as, Vienna sausage. I never got her to say it right. But anyway, I live in a state in Tennessee that we call the volunteer state. And that's because once upon a time, a lot of Tennesseans volunteered to supply fighters in the Mexican-American War. Davy Crockett, Alamo. Most of the guys who died at the Alamo were from Tennessee. My late Archbishop Dimitri called me one day on the phone. He almost never called a priest. He calls me on the phone. He goes, "Father Stephen." I said, "Yes." He said, "What do Tennesseans volunteer for?" And I said, "Well, to die in Texas, of course." And he said, "Well, I had something less in mind, but he got me to volunteer for something." But we imagine in America, we all imagine ourselves as volunteers. We imagine ourselves to be free, to be able to make our own decisions, and that our decisions and our choices define us.
The great evangelical mantra is make a decision for Christ. You know, the Billy Graham crusade. I got saved at the Billy Graham crusade. I've been saved so many times. But I'm in there, and Billy was great. You know, even Billy gives when he gives an altar call, you just walk. My daddy and I walked. We went down and got saved at Billy Graham, that was good for a few days. And, you know, first time I ever got saved, I was 7 years old, walked the aisle. They were singing, "Calling, O Sinner, Come Home," and I got homesick. And I walked the aisle. I just thought, I don't know where it is, but I want to go home. I'm going to be with Jesus. And the next week, the pastor visited our house, talked with me in the living room, that room where no one ever sat. You know, we sat there. There's a family Bible on the middle table that was never opened. I'll tell you about that in a minute. The preacher's there, talks with me, and he said to my mama, "Well, he's only 7 years old, but he's saved." I was baptized the next Sunday, but I was so small that I had to tread water in the baptismal thing. And so I'm not certain. I just kind of got bobbed instead of getting dunked, you know. I had to tell you this about the family Bible. Years later, I'm a priest. I'm home visiting, and the family Bible's there. And I have reason I'm in the living room, and I just got curious and opened up the Bible. And at some point, it falls open, and there is a beautiful, five-leafed marijuana leaf. In the family Bible. And I said, "Mama, there's pot in the Bible." And she goes, "Oh, yeah." She said, "You know, I found some of your brother's stash and I threw it out near the garbage can." She goes, "And I noticed one day it had started growing because there were obviously some seeds in it. He probably bought the cheap stuff." And she said, "It was growing." She says, "And it was just so pretty. I picked one and put it in the Bible." That's why I love you, Mama. It's just, the pot in the Bible. I was thinking, if only the preacher could come now. There was such innocence in that woman, you know, just not even concerned about that my little brother had that issue. But this great evangelical mantra is make a decision for Christ. It gives us a form of Christianity in which the sacraments are largely non-existent. I mean, for many of them, baptism is just an outward thing. It doesn't mean anything. Nothing's happening. All that matters is what happened in here. You made a decision for Christ. Now you're a Christian. That's it. The rest is just gravy. And so we're formed and shaped by our decisions. And this blends extremely well in a culture where human beings are defined as consumers. Your customers. We shop. Now, back in my Protestant years, Anglican, I would occasionally have a family, new in town, usually with a couple of kids, visit the church, and say to me unabashedly, "We're new in town, and we're church shopping." "Oh, good. Good. We're actually running a sale." You know, the Unitarians have much fewer commandments. Have you tried them? No. They don't ask anything of you. They were church shopping. And as I said, there was no embarrassment about this. We're shopping for churches. And, you know, probably mostly like preacher comparisons. Is he funny? Check. You know, I did my share. They shop in some ways for God. Such a God does not play hide and seek. No. Such a God is simply one of the passions. It's just one of the passions. That's why he works so well on bumper stickers. You know, the God of the bumper sticker. You can't get the gospel on a bumper sticker. Now, the bumper sticker I want, my wife won't let me have. Try to say this in a clean fashion. I think that's the reason she won't let me have it. It's not so clean in mine, but mine is just, "Jesus, drag my sorry soul. Jesus, drag my sorry soul into heaven." And because I told somebody, that's pretty much my theology, is I don't know if I can do this. I'm not certain about my decisions and my choices, but Jesus, I give you permission to drag me. Just heel marks all the way, drag me into heaven.
and I believe in a God who will. That's how I got here. God with them will not play hide and seek. He's simply one of the passions and something that fits and feels good and soothes. He serves the purpose they were shopping for. And of course, in the midst of this, there are legitimate relationships with Christ. I mean, making a decision for Christ is something. But the myth of the voluntaristic individual drags at those relationships with a host of accompanying problems. And, you know, it comes and goes. It comes and goes. And I have this for people. People talk to me like my teenager. You have a teenager and the teenager died, you know, and they're really upset, you know, because he died and he was an atheist when he died. And I'm thinking, yeah, that's an issue. But, you know, did he believe when he was 7? I said, yes, he did. He was such a sweet boy. And I thought, and he died in a teenager stage. It's kind of, I mean, I don't know about you, but I would not want to be judged on my 16-year-old self. But God is a big God, and he sees the whole of me from youth on up, and he not only sees the idiot I was at 16, at 16 he saw what I was going to become, the idiot I am now. But, you know, and he loves me for all of that, and that one too. It's like, you know, it's like, well, when he was going through this stage, did you disown him? No, we didn't. Did you love him? Yes. Why do you think God's somehow or another not as loving as you are? Because you've got some false notions about a rigid God who doesn't love us. You know, St. Isaac of Syria refers to God's, he talks about his manikos eros, which means his crazy love. God's crazy love. I like that. God loves me so much, he's just crazy in a good sense. But if you spend a lot of time on your computer or on your phone, which is a computer, you'll notice a very strange phenomenon. You search Google for a pair of pants, then you check your Facebook account as you scroll through. Ads for pants pop up everywhere. I like occasionally to shop for a Ferrari, Maserati, because it really upgrades my ads on Facebook, because it's actually the algorithms that search for Ferraris will also bring up a lot of other really cool stuff, Italian vacations and all kinds of things like that. I just like to yank Google's chain ever so often because I know, you know, I just pretend to be somebody I'm not. But of course, they're watching us, and there's these cookies, as they call them, scattered throughout all of your things, throughout the entire world of the internet, harvesting information about it, sharing it with those who want to sell us stuff. The Enlightenment, that great breakthrough that gave us science and technology that people talk about, and they'll say, talk about Voltaire in France and all these other figures of the Enlightenment, when the real Enlightenment that gave us modernity was the Scottish Enlightenment. It happens maybe 50 years or so later. The genius of the Scottish Enlightenment, the Scottish discovered the ability to not just come up with cool ideas like steam engines and stuff. What they discovered is the ability to monetize it. You know, why do they make new kinds of iPhones every other year? It's not because we desperately need a newer kind of iPhone. It's because they need newer profits. I mean, we were talking the other night, medical advances, you know, your medicines, you know, they invented insulin back, what, the 1920s or something like that, and the doctors who invented it purposely did not take out a patent because they wanted it available for everybody. But of course, all you got to do is change a little something about the insulin, and then you get a patent as a medical company, and you know, and you get. I've got a daughter who works in an endocrinology lab, and she just goes berserk about prices of insulin and how much time she has to spend on a telephone trying to get medicine for her poor patients in Memphis, Tennessee. And there ought not be there. Why is it monetized like that? Well, that's just kind of, you know, the modern world is driven not by science, not by technology. Science and technology are driven by money. It's about money. You are a money machine. Your humanity has been reversed to an ATM, and they have the card. Now, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I'm just telling you the truth about how we live. You are an ATM. You know,
I used the Matrix example. This is another version in the Matrix, where ATM machines, all they want is your money. My two daughters, oldest daughter, who's very, she never did anything wrong as a child, very, very straight. And my second daughter, who was my first princess, who was born. The two of them were watching television on a Saturday morning back in the 80s when television on Saturday morning was cartoons. And they're watching, and between each cartoon, there's these ads, toys, cereal, all this sort of stuff. And they're watching just glued to it. And I came up behind them and whispered and said, "All they want is your money." And my oldest daughter went, "Ooh." And my second daughter said, "How much?" And to this day, that really describes their personalities. It was torture to take my oldest daughter shopping. She'd never buy anything. My second daughter was like, "Baby, there's my shopping partner. Let's go shopping. Yes, sir, let's go. Papa's got cash, you know." And, oh, me. I got a call to Oak Ridge, Tennessee, to a church, and I'd been starving as a grad student at Duke, and like that, Christmas was coming, and I took my two girls, and I said, "We're going shopping." I said, "What for?" I said, "I'm going to buy you church dresses, because we're going into a new church, and I got a new job, and they're going to pay me, and I got money coming in so bad." I had such a good time, but I thought I was going to die trying to buy a dress for the oldest one, but joy, such joy. They want our money. And of course, if we notice, look, and think, all of these ads thrown at us, they work on, none of them work on the basis of rationality. They're not really comparison, true comparison ads or anything like that. They don't do that. They don't present the case to us for new pants. You know, like, why, if I've already got 6 pair of pants, do I actually need another one? Well, I don't have that color. You know, something like that. Bait. Clickbait. Bait is a very good term because, like fish in a lake, just a nibble. Just a small bite and the hook is set. We're reeled in. 2 or 3 button clicks and the sale is made. Maybe less. We really never engaged in rational thought. You didn't make a decision. On the whole, we follow impulses. And that's what the passions are. This is life lived in the passive voice. Do you remember your English grammar lessons? This is life in the passive voice. We do not act, we are acted upon. We react, but that's still response in a passive life. I've sometimes contemplated a tombstone in the passive voice. The tombstone says, "Stephen Freeman, a life was lived." Life in a passive voice in which you kind of go through being acted on, click, acted on, click, acted on, click. I'm not deciding anything. I'm just responding. I'm just as smart as a fish. Bait, bait, bait. And somebody's saying, "Oh, this is you affirming your existence. This is you becoming, this is lies, 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 lies. It's not the truth." And they're saying, "This is freedom of the will." No, it's not. Although we imagine ourselves as individuals who go through life willing things, this is not really accurate. We largely go through life fulfilling and yielding to various passions that act on us, subjects of a much larger social phenomenon that we call an economy or a society. I read this massive 900-page book this few years ago that was called, I could read it last year, it was by a professor up in New England somewhere, Catholic guy. But anyhow, I'm getting older. I can't remember. But anyway, it'll come to me when I'm not thinking about it. But he said that in modern society, the ontology of modernity is money. Like, does it matter? Money. I read the New York Times, which is kind of weird, and I read the Wall Street Journal, which is also kind of weird. And the Wall Street Journal will take the same articles as the New York Times, but analyzes everything in terms of the economy. It's like, war in Ukraine. Ooh, stock market's up. How's that? Ooh, pretty good, you know. We're a little nervous one day, but market's up like that. I just, you know, golly gee, as long as the market's up,
life is good.
The will, the actual will, the thing that we talk about theologically, that is free. The will is a fundamental force and orientation of our life. It's more than just a thought, but it's a thought in action that moves the whole of our being towards something. When the disciples left their nets and followed Christ, that's an act of the will. They left their business. You know, they had jobs and family and stuff. It's not merely a response to an itching curiosity. Oh, I wonder what he's talking about. You know, go back fishing. Or they weren't just satisfying a passing suggestion of a passion. It's the sort of thing that a week later you're not regretting and wondering if maybe you acted too hastily. This is, you know, what's amazing is that this response happens when Jesus just calls you. And all I can say is there's something about Jesus when he speaks your name, it grabs you to the very depth of your being. And you think, I can't live if I don't answer that. I cannot live without that. This is my name. The will is a fundamental force and orientation of our life. I think of phrases such as, he decided to go there, come hell or high water. That's a will. Okay? Or as the gospel says of Christ, he set his face to go to Jerusalem. That's the will. That's not shopping. Oh, I wonder how Jerusalem is this time of year. You know, this is one of the many reasons that orthodoxy makes people wait before becoming orthodox. I was talking to a young man. He'd been going to Holy Cross in Linthicum, Maryland, where Matthews Green, Father Gregory's the was the priest there. And this young man said, I was going there for 6 months. He said, and he never, ever tried to close the sale. I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, you know, you go to an evangelical church and you're going to get a card and a way to sign up pretty quickly. Pledge, do whatever. He said, I've been going there for 6 months and Father Gregory hasn't even asked me whether I want to be Orthodox. I said, well, believe it or not, you need to tell him if you want to be Orthodox. He'll let you come there for ever so long. And I have occasionally laid that heart and said to someone who's been visiting a while, you know, if you ever get really interested and want to do this, ask me. I'll show you how it's done. But, you know, we're no hurry. You know, I mean, part of it is, I tell people, look, you don't understand. I believe that everybody comes through the door of my church is called to be there. You know, you probably thought you had a choice. You didn't even know yet. You're kind of making it, but here you are. I believe God sent you. I don't know how this is going to work. It took me 20 years. You know, I ran away a lot. It took me 20 years. I don't know. I'm not in a big hurry. You know, Jesus loves you. Jesus is saving you right now, whether you know it or not. I'm not worried about that. I just, you know, want to do this in what is in your best interest. And so we make people wait. It's good. The will needs that. The will doesn't need pressure. The will doesn't need clickbait. The will doesn't need someone pushing me to make a decision. The will is, God is saying, I want all of you. I want the whole of you. I want you to jump off this cliff with me. You know, this is how we're going to do this. Me and you are going to be on the cross, okay? You know, this is, you got to think about that one. And God is good. He lets us do that. I want to say something about willpower. They used to talk about that in, you know, dieting books, willpower. And if there is such a thing, I don't think we would have the phrase if there were no such thing. But the will alone is not enough to propel us through life. It's a fundamental orientation and a directing of our whole self towards an end, but it was never meant to stand by itself. We are more than willing individuals. Orthodox theology, particularly St. Maximus the Confessor, describes the will as having two major components. At least that's how we experience the will as fallen creatures. The primary component of the will is what he described as being the natural will, the will of your nature. And this is the fundamental will of our nature, and it always wants, the fundamental natural will always wants to be what a human being is supposed to be. Its desire is always, always, always towards its proper end and goal. In that sense, the natural will is not fallen. Your nature, you know, I like to tell, especially folks who've come out of, say, a reform background, and they've got all this stuff that human nature is fallen, and we're, you know, masa damnata, as that's like, which means a damned lump. which is our lump of damnation in Luther's language. Luther described us as a snow-covered dunghill, you know, and so you're like, original sin is just completely corrupted you. And I tell them, I said, you know, the Orthodox Church believes that human beings are inherently good. Your nature is not fallen. Our fallenness is that we seem to not be able to live in union with our nature. But your nature's good. Everybody I talk to, everybody I meet wants to be an Orthodox Christian. They just don't know it yet. You know, and I'm probably the problem. It's just helping them to become what God had created them to become. And this is not like some denomination and choice among things like that. This is life. This is the fullness of God. But he says there is this natural will that always desires this. But then he said there's this other thing. And his term in Greek was the nomic will, G-N-O-M-I-C, nomic will, or translated as the choosing will. And this is a will that we all live with and operate with on a daily basis. It's fragmented and broken away sort of from the natural will. And so it's confused. It doesn't quite know what to do. And it kind of halts between two things and kind of makes decisions and sort of and goes back and does things like this. So Paul describes it in Romans 7, uses different language. He says, the good that I will to do, I don't do it. That's the natural will, the will that I will to do. I don't do it. That's the nomic will. The evil that I don't want to do, the natural will doesn't want to do evil. That's what I do, he says. That's the nomic will. But if I do what I do not will to do, it's no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells in me, or we would say a broken nomic will. So that part of what's going on slowly in our Orthodox life and what we call theosis is a healing of the will. A healing so that the will that I live in is lining up increasingly with the will I was created with, that my nature, that I actually do what I'm supposed to do. I mean, that I become Stephen. The real Stephen, you know, not this ersatz, shame-driven little Appalachian boy with his confusion and neuroses and things like that. You know, I've always tell people, do not confuse your neurosis for God. It's not the same thing. But this thing in me that desires and longs for God and propels me towards Him, that I can somehow or another find the healing, as Paul talks about, so I'm no longer doing this sinful, broken will, but what God intends for us. So there is a fundamental conflict within us, a will that always desires good, that which is natural to being human, and a will that is uncertain and fumbles around between one thing and another, sometimes getting it right, sometimes not. But it's little wonder that with such an inner conflict, we sometimes get tired and just want to live a life dominated by the passions. It doesn't take a lot of work to be passive. You just sit back, and it'll take you along with it. Oh, and it will take you. You know, you just kind of yield to the passions. You know, it's like marriage is really hard work. Pornography is easy. Yeah, that's passive stuff. You don't have to be kind to her. You don't have to be generous. You don't have any of that. It's just all like magic. You always get what you want. If not, it's two clicks away or one click, just endlessly. That's living life under the passions. The will calls us to this difficult life. If I were to say to you, what do you want? What do you want? How would it strike you? Would you be excited? Would you be troubled? How would you even know the answer to the question, what do you want? Imagine standing before God and God saying to you, what do you want? What do you want? You know, I would like to think my answer would be you. I want you. You know, with my wife, what do I want? I want her. I want the walls to come down between us, the games, the shame. I want to know you, and I want to be known. I believe it's correct to say that the search for God is equally a search for the truth of ourselves. The natural will is a given, though it's frequently obscured by the many passions that bind and obscure our lives. St. Augustine said, we are created for thee, O Lord, and our hearts are restless until they find their rest in thee. That's a gift from God.
If it weren't for the natural will pointing constantly and steadily towards God, it would only be an occasional accidental thing that anybody ever found him. People get panicked. They will read, as you know, statistics on declines in churches and stuff. The demographics in certain places look bad. Or, you know, I saw a video the other day, and someone said, you know, that Christianity in the West is dying and it cannot recover. And he gives a bunch of demographic proof about how that's so. And I just think, dude, you don't know. You don't know. It's because it's sown deep in our hearts, and we will not give it up. We will not give it up. You know, the Soviet Union was described as hopelessly atheist. Albania was described as the first atheist state. Hukna had made such an oppression of it, nobody identified it or dared say that they believed in God. You know, you should have seen the crowds. I saw videos this year at Pascha in Tirana, Albania, and the vast crowds that were there. One of our American priests who did, Greek priests who did work in Albania, started 95 churches. When I heard that, I quit bragging about the five I helped start. About 95, with more atheists than you can shake a stick at. Why? Because they hunger for God. Hukna was not a good God. I remember talking to this Chinese girl from communist China, doing work over at the University of Tennessee, and she said, "I don't see what you need God for." I said, "What do you mean?" She goes, "Well, you've got the state, and you've got your family. Why do you need God?" I thought, this is going to be a very interesting conversation. And it was. But I was trying to think, there's a... And I did spend some time talking about how that state thing wasn't working out exactly. I mean, I understand you think the state is God, but, you know, when he's mousy dung and he's killed 60 million of you, how's that working for you? You know, it's dark. But it was very interesting. We learned. Our efforts in the church of asceticism, fasting, prayer, almsgiving, serve to direct us towards this natural goal that you want to give God. You want to be generous. You want to do it. You want to give your life to God. Dr. Timothy Petitsis, some of you know that family, from Akron, I think, originally. He's at Holy Cross. His recent book, The Ethics of Beauty, writes wonderfully about what he terms proper shame. It's the same as I've described as healthy shame. Following the language of clinical studies, I've called it healthy shame, bearing the truth of who I am in the presence of God. But Petitsis wrote and said this: proper shame is not easily defined, but we can begin by saying that it is the glow of a worshiping and healthy human soul. Not just me saying this stuff, okay? Dr. Petitsis says the same is the glow of a worshiping and healthy human soul. Secularism, on the other hand, he says, is the attempt to strip the world of all religious meaning and to put man in God's central place. Secularism tries to stop us from worshiping, and in order to do that, it has to stop us from feeling healthy shame. He says shame and secularism are mortal enemies. The world doesn't want anybody to feel bad. It wants everybody to feel good. Don't tell me that abortion is murder. That hurts my feelings. You know? Don't tell me that, you know, that I don't have complete command of my body. You know, that kind of limits my choices. You know, don't say these things to me. Don't do that. Of course, then we get caught up in shaming each other. It's all very... None of this is really trying to find what it means to be truly. I mean, they say that no one ever said on his deathbed, "I wish I'd spent more time in the office." You know, I remember laying in the cath lab when I had my heart attack, and I'm on the table there, and it's one of those exciting things. You go in the hospital, kind of wondering about it, and they come into the room and say, "Mr. Freeman, you're having a heart attack." Well, this is what a heart attack feels like. I thought I'd swallowed a tennis ball. That's the old elephant on my chest. And they take me back in there and you know, kind of looking to see what's going on. And it is a sobering thought. And you think to yourself, is this my last heart attack? Like, the last, the big one? Is it? And I knew too many stories of people, like, you know, coding on the table, you know, and thinking, well,
How's this going to be? And they wanted to give me something to numb me up, you know, kind of relax me as they did this. And I said, nope, I have work to do. This might be my last heart attack. And if it is, I've got work to do. You guys work and I'll pray. And, you know, but it's amazing to me how many problems back at the parish and elsewhere that I wasn't thinking about at all. This is a maybe come to Jesus moment. And the agenda got very small, like, I'm so sorry, something like that, you know. Jesus, save me. I'm here. If this is it, I'll see you in a minute, you know, whatever. But I have treasured my death on the table. I've treasured it. It's just a constant reminder. I mean, the monks say you should always keep death before your eyes. Well, I've got one. And so I just kind of keep it in front of my eyes because chances are I'll be back there again. Something like that's going to take me out. Chances are. You had one, you'll probably have another. I'm doing all the stuff, but still, it'll probably get me. And I just want to be ready when it comes. But, you know, that's a clarifying moment. What was I human? Was I human? Did I love? Did I forgive? Did I make everybody's life harder in the worst sense? You know, was my life not a life was lived, but he lived. He lived actively. He lived. I was talking to two little teenage girls, maybe 15 years old, 14, 15, the other day at church, and I was sitting out talking with them, and they were getting stories out of me. Can you imagine? And I was telling them stuff. And when I first became Orthodox, I worked for 2 years as a hospice chaplain, so taking care of dying people. And I was telling them about this and some things from that. And one of them, we finished, she said to me, "You're a good person." I thought, am I a good person? It's like in that movie, what was it, Saving Private Ryan? At the end of it, the man asking the question, was I a good man? All these men, some of the good men gave their lives so I could live. Some good men gave their lives so we could live. Was I a good man? You know, and that's measured by Christ. You know, it's measured by Christ. So that's the will. How's our time? Okay, good, good. Okay. The church has, I mentioned yesterday about boundaries. The boundaries ultimately are here to reveal the true nature of beauty to us, the true nature of the beauty of the soul, the true nature of our beauty in relationship to God, the true beauty of God. It's interesting. I watched this film years ago. It was made in the 1970s. It was a BBC program on religions of the world. And they got around to Christianity, and smartly they decided not just to talk about Christianity, but they did a show 1 week on Catholic Christianity, show another week on Protestant Christianity, another show on Orthodox Christianity, 1970s. And this BBC journalist type guy goes to Romania, to talk communist Romania, to talk about Orthodoxy. And it's very interesting as he visits. I mean, it's really great. He's in this one town in which they're building a church, and the president of the building committee is also the local leader of the Communist Party. And he asked him, isn't there a contradiction between, you know, a member of an atheist Communist Party and being the president of the church council and building the church? And the guy just said, and I'm thinking, yeah, I mean, he's building the church, you know, it's like, yeah, I think he's just giving lip service to his job. He's building the church. But anyway, it was interesting as this guy's going around and exploring things, and his guide was someone who worked for the Patriarchate in Bucharest, and they're together, and he says to him, the most obvious question, he says, what do the Orthodox believe? Good question. But the man said to him, well, you should rather ask, instead of what do the Orthodox believe, you should ask us, whom do you worship? And then gave an explanation of Orthodoxy. in terms of who it is we worship. We worship God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. It's interesting that when St. Cyril and Methodius started working with the Slavs in Bulgaria, Macedonia area, and started translating the scriptures and the service books into Slavonic, how did they treat the word Orthodox? Well, they translated it Pravoslavny. Orthodoxy for us too often has come to mean right doctrine. Yeah? Orthodoxy. Ortho, right, doxy, doctrine, right? And instead, our right belief could be translated that way, but Cyril and Methodius had certainly been nurtured in the heart of Constantinople, and they knew their stuff. And what word did they find in Slavonic to translate doxy? Slava, glory. Orthodoxy in Greek, doxa also means glory, and more does it mean glory than it does mean doctrine. Orthodoxy means right glory, right worship. So pravoslavny, we worship God. And in fact, this was very so much the Orthodox mindset. The first great divisions between us and the Catholics wasn't really about the filioque in the creed that does come up, but the really biggest one that even had a schism earlier was the argument over whether or not the bread should be leavened or unleavened. The Orthodox said it should be leavened. The Catholics had unleavened. Now, as moderns, we would say, dude, just chill. It's just bread. Yeah, isn't that enough? The Orthodox said, no, unleavened bread isn't risen. Yeah, this is Jewish bread. This is the old Passover. Christ is our leavening. He should be in the bread. It's right, you know, it's like, you know, grape juice. Why not grape juice? Because it's not risen. The alcohol, the fermentation is resurrected grape juice. Yeah, the bread, resurrected bread. And so, but they thought that was enough to, and in fact, historically, the Orthodox practice is the oldest practice, as usual. But that can be documented. But the notion, that bothered them. And it really had to do with right worship, that somehow or another, if you play the game wrong, I talked about playing earlier, if you play the game wrong, you start coming to wrong conclusions. And so you have to get this right. How we worship is, you know, there's an old saw in theology that says, lex orandi, lex credendi. The law of praying is the law of believing. And I was in the Anglican Church, we switched things. They got rid of our old prayer book, put in a new prayer book. They pulled the altar out to be freestanding, and they lied to us. They said, well, all of the ancient churches and archaeology show that the altar in the early church was freestanding. If they'd go to an Orthodox church, they'd see why. Why is it freestanding? Because you got to walk around it. But where does the priest stand? Always in front of it. Why? Because he faces east. To the Orient on high, he faces east and the people face east because we face God, we pray to God. You put the priest on the other side and you're doing that because I've done it. It's kind of like me and you and us, and it's kind of a picnic table. It doesn't mean to be that, but there's a subtle, and I was involved and knew people and studied under people who were involved in those changes, and there was some intentional stuff of changing the fundamental architecture of liturgy and the fundamental architecture, knowing that if you change the architecture, you'll change the belief. You know, the Orthodox, we stand here, we face God. And so the question is, what does God want? I stand here like this and I face y'all. What do y'all want? I used to say I served one church, I had three masses on Sunday. It was Burger King. You know, have it your way. There were three different masses and they all didn't like each other. And so I was three different priests. I served one, then I served the next, and I served the third. Have it your way. That will make you crazy. It's hard to maintain any integrity like that. What am I? I am a full service agent. You know? What do you want? And if you're at the least bit prone to people pleasing, it'll reward you. It is like biofeedback for selling out. It was the heart, and people say, why did it take you so long to be Orthodox? I said, well, I was having a real hard time not selling my soul. When I became Orthodox, I said I entered the church as a penitent. One of the things I was being penitent for, there's a sin, a Russian would say, it's dvoya dusha, being two-souled. They have two souls. St. James says, disiki in Greek, two sikis, two souls. Dvoya dush in Russian, two souls. And St. James says, do not be, it's usually translated, do not be double-minded, but it's do not be two-souled. For a two-souled man, he says, is unstable in all his ways. You know, and so you're just kind of so used to just get trained in that, and it's hard to just do something. And finally, I mean, when I finally made my decision that I'm going to do this and pulled the trigger and, you know, got a job and left the Episcopal Church, and my job paid about half of what my Episcopal salary was. That was scary. I had four kids and some things, and start off then with a little warehouse, and it just felt like jumping off a cliff. And it was like, if this is jumping off a cliff, I mean, at one point, the warehouse we were renting, I had the lease. Diocese of the South was in terrible financial order. I signed the lease, $800 a month for a warehouse, and I said to Beth, if this thing doesn't work, we're going to be bankrupt. But I can't think of a better reason to be bankrupt. We're going to do this. We're just going to have to do this. And it wasn't just me. There were priests, and this is true. I mean, there's this great moment of people coming into the church. There have been priests who've been working a job and serving their church and just giving of their money. By the time we'd finished, I'd had about $25,000, $30,000 in saving in a few years. That was all gone. It's mostly gone to the church. We were just, you know, priests are doing this, not just mission work, but financing their mission work. There's a reason why there's an Orthodox church filling with converts, and there's some men who've been laying down their lives and their wives and their children doing this, allowing this to happen. It's God's will. He's doing things, but it's not easy. It's not easy. Just, you know, have respect for them, you know, and it's still going on. Very often priests are in difficult circumstances, but what is helpful to us is that it is God to whom we are faithful. It is God's word that we teach. It is God's law that we obey. And this is healing us and making us able to say to you, you've got to do this. You know, do this. This will help. This will make a difference. This will bring you in union with God. Your heart has actually always wanted to do this. This is your life and your soul. You know, and for a fragmented culture in which we are pulled in every way by all of these economic forces that are promising us things that they never deliver, you know, it's like voting. Someone said if voting made a difference, they'd never let us do it, you know. And maybe it can make a difference. This last week was interesting, but, you know, it's just not like that. But to be God's person, God's man, God's woman, in union with him, that is worth this direction of the will. And the church works with us to help us begin to recover that, to be of one mind and one heart. That requires love, it requires devotion, and it requires learning how to deal with the things that would draw us away from that, whether that's shame or the passions or whatever. And just hold on to each other and do that. So I want to stop for questions there. It seems I've almost preached out. So it's been good, these three sessions. It's a lot of talking, which I do like to do, and God help me. And I think to myself, I was always going to talk this much. Just imagine what I'd been saying if I was saying something else. My oldest daughter, back in her Episcopal years, my oldest daughter said to me, she goes, no, when I was a young teenager, she goes, I couldn't figure out whether I wanted to be a priest, because they had women priests. She goes, I didn't figure out if I wanted to be a priest or a comedian. I thought, you wanted to be your daddy. So anyway, thank you for the time, for the invitation to come up here. For your giving of precious weekend time and just the wonderful hospitality. I've been extremely well taken care of, and I'm enjoying it. Good to get to know a priest. We have connections He knew my son-in-law when he was knee-high to a grasshopper, and he and my co-father-in-law came into the church at the same time, same day. And so, who is? Very good. Well, we've, you know, there's, I mean, as we all know, Orthodoxy is a small world and we get connected, but it's just, it's beautiful to, for me to have been here and to be part of your small world, and I appreciate it. I especially have been appreciative of people who've said encouraging words to me about things they've read or things they've listened to that I've done. You know, it's encouraging. I don't know, it's a little bit like saying sick 'em to a dog, but because, you know, pat me on the head for talking. It's like, oh yeah, this is, don't encourage him. But it has been encouraging. And so I ask and pray, ask your prayers for this book on shame that I hope to have coming out this year, if all that goes right, and that it'll be useful. I mean, it doesn't have to do anything else, but being useful is about as good a thing as you can do. But so, last questions here. Yes, please. Yeah.
And you mentioned about maybe some asceticism practices, whether that's one way of doing it. Could you give me more practical ways, a kind of a little bit more litany or wisdom, some practical things that can help me to develop more of my natural will versus the other?
Yeah. Well, one of the things is, first off, is kind of gradually getting more knowledge of what our nature really is. I mean, that your nature does desire God. You know, it's like when we talk about beginning a day with prayer, oftentimes people get caught up in doing that like a duty, like I said my prayers. And that can also be like a life was lived, so that you're doing your prayers passively, like you read the prayers, now I've read them, and check it off, or, you know, and I didn't do my prayers, so guilty, you know, whatever. But that's kind of what it is. That's not getting you very far. And I'm not against that, but I've sometimes think, you know, people get kind of asked questions about we use written prayers. The purpose of written prayers in the Orthodox Church is actually to teach you how to pray, not to give you your prayers. You know, and sometimes, like for instance, with shame language, some of these prayers are written by a bunch of old Greek monks, and they're written in really flowery shame language that is like, you don't even think that. You know, you think, oh man, you know, it's just... And I tell, in some people, especially if you're dealing with toxic shame, you just find it hard to use those words. And so when I'm working with people, I say, don't use those words. Just make new words. It's not a problem. It doesn't have to be those prayers. We can write prayers, use that as a model, but say other things, you know. So, but anyway, starting your day intentionally, like that my day is, I want to start my day with God. I know that, and, you know, and it's possible to get caught up in all the stuff you got to do. You know, was that important? I mean, I know that, you know, being a mama, being a wife, being all the, you know, shopping, doing whatever, grocery buying, you know, paying the bills, those have a kind of importance. But, you know, God is what's important. As Jesus said of Mary, neglecting Martha, she's chosen the one thing needful. So you're beginning the day by saying, in a way, asking the question of the natural will, asking the question of God, you know, what do I need today? What do I need today? You know, and a prayer that says, you know, God, help me to do what you need me to do for my soul's health, for my life, what is needful today? And that can take a lot of forms and stuff, but it's sort of being intentional about it. I think practicing, learning to practice a kind of intentionality about how we use technology is very easy because it trains you to be passive. It works by your passivity, you know. And so being a little bit more intentional about it, that I'm opening my computer, what do I want to do? And do it. When you're done, close it. Oh, my goodness. The electricity bills will drop. Living more intentionally in our relationships, where I'm not passively going through my relationships and just reacting so that they set me off and get angry or whatever like that, is that how do I love my spouse today? How do I support them? How do I nurture them? How do I care about who they, how do I lay down my life for them today? What does that look like today? And there's ways in which we are, you know, becoming more intentional. And you could get weird about this and just kind of, you know, this is not talking about some zombie existence, but I mean, just trying to get your life back. Somebody else, you don't become a battery in the matrix. You know, be intentional. And as much as possible, you know, paying attention. There's a story in the Desert Fathers. It was rumored that this monk was keeping a woman in his cell, and the other monks got all upset about it, and they were going to come find her and throw her out and probably have a few words to say to this monk, maybe beat him a little. And the elder, the Abba in the community, hurries ahead of the crowd, and he gets to the young, to the monk's cave. And as he's going in the cave, he sees a woman kind of disappear. They had some tall jars for storing stuff. He saw her kind of hide in one of these tall jars. And he goes over, puts a lid on it, and he sits on the lid. And so all the monks come in. Where is she? Where is she? Like this, you know, and they go, and they go. But they have such respect for him that they don't say move so he can search the jar. They search everything else, but not the jar he's sitting on. And when they leave, I love this, the old monk just gets up from it. He says to the young monk, he said, pay attention to yourself, and left. Pay attention to yourself. Doesn't say, what are you thinking, whatever, you know, anything like that. Just pay attention to yourself. Maybe this monk needs to give up the desert and go marry her. You know, pay attention to yourself. But don't live this double life. Don't be that guy. Don't pretend to be a monk while you're doing this. You know, I mean, all of that. Just pay attention to yourself. So that's part of it. It's a healthy thing in the healthy sense. Not just what is my pleasure, but what is my existence? Who am I? Who do I want to be today? How do I want to be? So that's how I would kind of, that's sort of what I try to do a little bit these days. After I figured out how to move in the morning, my physical therapist told me arthritis likes to move. That if you don't get up and move around, it's going to get worse. Because, and the last thing it does, it feels like, don't move. Just don't move. And I get up. So my first thing in the morning, I finish my prayers at the house, is to go tell my wife, I'm going for my walk. And, you know, eventually, hopefully, you get enough where you can stand up straight and do that. Another question, maybe, or even thoughts. You may have a comment. That's cool, too. It's here first, yeah? You first.
Yesterday at the end of the session, I wrote down the word nevertheless.
Yes, yes, yes.
And I know it was an anecdote about your father-in-law,
yep. He said, I mean, he practiced giving thanks always and for all things in an extreme manner. I mean, he was rigid about it, rigidly thankful. When my wife brought me home to visit for the first time, I had long hair, I smoked, I drank, I was a hippie Jesus freak, living in a commune without a lot of promise. She brought me home, and they treated me fine. And 9 months before we got married, I was hospitalized with a clinical depression. I was in my sophomore year of college. It was not pretty. We got married 9 months later, but I said to him years later, I said, you know, you guys treated me like I was your son from the moment she brought me home. I said, and I was in the hospital, crazy, 9 months before I married her. I said, you know, I've got daughters now. We got young men are going to be, they're going to be bringing young men home. I said, and 9 months after I'm in the hospital, she's going to marry me, and you never said to her, you know, y'all might want to slow down, think a little bit, see how Steve's going to be. Maybe he's going to be more crazy than this as it goes on, you know, anything like that, things that a reasonable father might do. And I said, how did you do that? I mean, she's his firstborn baby girl. And he said, well, he said, the day she was born, we began to give thanks for the man she would marry. So when she brought you home, we just continued to give thanks and trusted that God knew what he was doing. And I thought to myself when I realized that when I married my wife, she gave me the most amazing dowry a woman could possibly have, which was 21 years of the prayers of a righteous couple for me, who had been praying for me since about the time I was born. Though I didn't know it, God knew it. And so I was the beneficiary of a man who gave thanks for all things. He never treated me as anything other than a good man, even when I wasn't maybe so good and fine to catch. It just worked differently. They were so supportive of us all the way through in various things we did. And he would have said, well, I looked at him. Nevertheless, I gave thanks to God. Nevertheless, I'll tell you another quick story. I love that man. He had another one of his verses he'd claimed was that God promises us 70 years, 70 years and 10. He decided that was a promise, not just a description in the scripture, but a promise. And I would argue with him when I was a young, crazy theologian and try to explain to him that, this was a man, by the way, who had walked across Europe with a carbine in his hand in World War II, trusting and giving thanks to God for all things, who missed the Battle of the Bulge because he got appendicitis just before the battle was pulled behind the lines, and when he got back, his whole company was gone. Giving thanks to God for all things, but at age 68, he and my mother-in-law were in a terrible car wreck. They were T-boned by a truck. And we got a phone call. They were in the ICU and were not expected to make it. We drove through the night from Durham, North Carolina, down to Aiken, South Carolina, where they lived. We went in, and they're laying in there and all hooked up and, all these machines and stuff like that. And I thought, I know their Baptist pastor. He married my wife and me. And I knew, though he liked him, he wouldn't pray with Austin the way Austin, my father-in-law, was used to being prayed for. And I thought, well, I will pray for him that way. So I go into his room, and I'm in the ICU, and I just started praying for Austin based on what Austin believed. And I was giving God thanks for the car wreck, just thanking him profoundly for this car wreck. And I reminded God, he's only 68 years old, and you promised him 70. And I'm just standing here to bear witness that Austin believed that. And in the name of Jesus, I'm claiming it for Austin. So, and I finished up. Now, this is a hospital in the South, so nurses are also theologians. And so I come out of that room, and a nurse takes me aside. She goes, I couldn't help overhearing your prayer. And I'm thinking, yeah, I thought I was praying pretty good. And she said to me, she goes, we were concerned that you might not understand just how serious this is, and that you might be getting your hopes up. And I said to her, oh, I know exactly how serious this is, but I wasn't hoping in you. Yeah, yeah. Well, Austin, of course, was out of it. He was totally, out of it and all of that. But I later told him that when he recovered. He died in his 80s. I told him that when he recovered. And every so often we'd get together, he'd say, tell me about the prayer in the hospital. I wasn't hoping in you. And all I can say is I have been blessed because I've seen a man walk like that. I was the beneficiary of a man walking like that. He walked like an Orthodox saint, Baptist to his bones. But he walked like an Orthodox saint. And I love him, and I love anybody like him. And he taught me a lot. I would argue with him. I used to love him, and I'd argue with him, get him backed in a corner, and he would say, well, I don't know about that. And that's all he would say. He wouldn't say more, wouldn't argue more, wouldn't push me. He'd just say, well, I don't know about that. But his life was the most eloquent possible argument for these things. Does God always do that? Could he have died from the accident? It's not even a question. Maybe, who knows? It just wasn't the question he was asking. He was instead hoping in God who had promised him. He heard it as a promise to him. And he'd probably heard it when he was walking in Normandy and the bullets are flying around you. He trusted in God. All I can say is I saw a life well lived. sixth grade school teacher. You know, in South Carolina, that's not like a good paying position. Just so faithful, just so faithful. Would tithe, tenth of that school thing. Then he retired and he thought, you know, anybody can tithe. He wouldn't even buy insurance. That's where I would argue with him. He said, no, I was just not trusting God. Try to argue with that. What kind of, this is just, you know, he just like that. And when he retired, he said, anybody can tithe. So he promised God that for every year beyond his 65 and he retired, he would increase his tithe by 1%. So next year I'll give 11 and I'll give 12. I mean, what kind of guy does that sort of stuff? Well, we write stories about them in the Orthodox Church. And, you know, and it came time and they had Medicare. And then they have the section of Medicare that's optional. Well, he just, no. If I have to have this other and you order me, I'll obey, but I'm not going to do this. So nope. And we're thinking, you guys are heading into nursing home. Your wife has Parkinson's and da-da-da-da-da. And we're just looking at all this. They died and each of the four children got $30,000 of inheritance. I don't even know how they had that money anywhere. I mean, we thought we were all going to have to pay for them. And instead, there was an abundance. He used to fuss at me as an Episcopal priest. I told him I was teaching people to tithe, but I'd tell him, just start small. Give 1%, then move to 2. You can move up to 10. And he'd say, well, that's trying to wean them from adultery. he said, if you don't tithe, you're robbing from God. And I thought, oh, you think I'm going to preach that in my Episcopal church? Yeah, people who hold their wallets up when they get baptized, you know, so they don't get wet, you know. But, oh dear. But, you know, it's possible to live by the Word of God. It's possible to live a nevertheless life. I probably needed a man like that in my life because I struggled so with being double-minded and tempted by so many things. And there were things, I think in some ways, finally when I became Orthodox, he would never have told me I needed to do a thing like that, but I kind of was almost increasingly ashamed that I was what I was. But all of this was kind of going on. And when I told him what we were doing and stuff like that, he just said, well, amen. You know, and anything we can do to help you, you know we will. And I knew he would. But I mean, it mattered more to me to have that man's respect than anything else I could have had. You know, so this, nevertheless, are we getting there? How's your time? You're all good. Another one, please, you had there.
I mean, in confession, we ask for God's forgiveness.
Yeah?
But yet, we have a hard time ourselves forgiving each other.
Yeah.
So if you could talk
to
John about forgiveness.
Jesus uses a lot of times images of debt. In my diocese, we pray, forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. It's an alternative way to say the Our Father. I did a sermon once on forgiveness and did the kids, right? I had some string, and I gave one a string. Hold on to that. And I said, you know, this is Susie, and Elizabeth over here was gossiping about you last week. You heard about it, so I give her another end of the string. And on we go. And when I finished up, the congregation was a stringy mess, all like a spider's web, all tied together. I said, now, holding your string, run. Well, nobody could even move. I mean, I'd kind of tied them up into a ball. And that's a little bit like how the lack of forgiveness works in our life, is you owe me. You know, and especially I think what happens when you injure someone, it's actually shaming, and that's part of its power. When we say he made me mad, anger generally is a secondary reaction to shame. You shame me, and I get angry. I don't even know that I was shamed, because the anger happens so fast. Psychologists say shame is so unbearable that we morph it either into anger or sadness. Men statistically more often morph it to anger, women to sadness, but it's about 60-40. But, it's kind of like, do you want to stay tied up? Do you want to stay bound? Can you, It's not just letting them go, it's letting you go. So we have self-interest in this, a good self-interest. I have used a practice how to forgive people. There's people I've had in my life that hurt me in a way that I could hardly even mention their name. Like if I'm doing my prayers and I mention their name, suddenly I don't even want to pray. I don't want to stop. I just stay away from it. And it's just that painful. It's bitterness. It's awful. But there it was. It's in my soul like a soul wound. And I finally thought, I have got to do something with this. So I began to pray this way. Lord, on the day of judgment, this way ways. Lord, on the day of judgment, do not hold this against them on my account. I'm not certain I can let them go right now, but I'm going to let them go for judgment. Let them go on judgment day. Do not hold this against them on my account. And it actually began to be something that I could pray. That I was like letting them go eventually, and I'll do that right now. And interestingly, my experience has been is that I started doing that, it began to move back and closer to where I've gotten in some of these cases where I find myself. Another thing I found was that oftentimes people who injured me, that's only one thing they did. Oftentimes they may have done good things to me too. And so I began, instead of thinking about the injury, thinking of the good things. And so I would pray and just remember the good things before God and ask them to reward them for these good things they did to me. Not mentioning the injuries, but just the good things. And because what's going on in this, in sort of those kinds of prayers, is I'm trying to soften my heart. It's my heart that's hard. That's why I don't forgive. It's like clay when you first buy it. It's hard, and you have to squeeze it in your hands. You warm it up until eventually it gets soft and pliable, and you do something with it. Well, our hearts are like that. My heart is hardened because of these injuries, so I need to warm my heart. How do I warm my heart towards them? Well, I forgive them at a distance. I remember good things. I find ways to bless them. One old Baptist preacher that I ran into once in a hospital, was talking with him, and he said to me, I don't know if I can say this on recordings here. He said, "You ever notice that you never bury a son of a bee?" Okay, and he said it out loud, you know, and I thought, that's interesting language for a Baptist preacher. He said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, you notice you go to a funeral," he said, "and no matter how lousy the person was, the guy in the pulpit's preaching and saying good things about him." And I thought, yeah, I've seen that. He said, "You know why that is?" I said, "No, I don't." I was thinking to myself, because the preacher's a liar or what? He said, "No." He said, "Because you can't let it go unless you bless it." There's some wisdom in that. You can't let it go until you bless it. You know? And that can be for many things. I had a friend who lost a spouse in a car wreck that he carried for years, and he talked about eventually getting to the place where he could finally bless God for the car wreck. A long time, a very deep thing, but you know, it's a wound, and the wound injures you and radiates out and colors things. It's just stuff. You know, I grew up with an alcoholic father. I saw many very difficult things I experienced as a child, and you know, abuse that was done and stuff like that. On the other hand, I see now, as an old man, I wouldn't be who I am without it. It was an awful way to get there, but God is so good that nevertheless, he, you know, is Joseph said to his brothers, "You meant it to me for evil, but the Lord meant it to me for good." I mean, it's always wrong to sell your brother as a slave to the Egyptians, but God meant it to good, and through it saved Joseph, his family, and, you know, and Egypt as well. And so God, the world may mean it to me for evil, God meant it to me for good, which is to give myself the chance to bless God for the good he intended instead of letting the evil become everything. That's what happens when we hold on to the stuff in the wrong way. We magnify the evil when we should magnify the good. You think of it, you go outside, you walk outside the door right now, and you look out there, the world is wonderful. The sun is shining. It's almost as warm as Tennessee, you know. It's just great out there. You know, some people go out there and they think the climate's changing, thinking it's always changing. They call it weather. sure. No, but anyway, I mean, you just kind of can get in panic mode and all you see is darkness. Well, yeah, there's plenty of darkness out there, but the truth is like 99.9999999% of everything outside the door is good. It just is. There's just lots of goodness. But, you know, media and news and stuff like that, bad sells. Good just sounds boring. But, you know, spend your time giving thanks for the good stuff. Get in practice. Good things, good things, good things. Nevertheless-ing the world. Nevertheless-ing those whom you need to forgive. They hurt me, O Lord. Nevertheless, forgive them. This is the one thing Jesus tells us, that if we do this, we will be like our Father in heaven. You want theosis? Here it is. If you do this, you will be like your Father in heaven, for he makes his sun to shine on the just and the unjust, the rain to fall on the just and the unjust. God does these things to both the good and the evil. So if you want to be like God, bless your enemies. That's why Jesus tells us to do these things. You know, it's like, you want to be like God? He just blesses everybody. People said, what about Hitler? He loved him. He loved him. He remembered when he was a little boy. And he wasn't like that. He loved him. You don't love him? I'm sorry. You know, God loves him. I don't know how, but he loves him. You know, and God's got a crazy love. Like I said, St. Isaac says this, and it's kind of, it helps us to be a little crazy in this God way. You know, it's exhausting, but it's good, and it's our nature. Yeah, back yonder. Yeah. Well, I got to tell you, on ruining the liturgy, a priest told me that a priest has allowed 7 mistakes per liturgy. There's another story of a Greek priest whose angel, he always saw his angel with him in the altar, and he was doing something wrong consistently, and the bishop came, and when the bishop was there, he corrected him. And the guy said, and he fussed at his angel the next time in his liturgy. He said, why have you never told me that? And the angel said, oh, I'm just an angel. You're a priest. Angels can't correct priests. I love that story, but anyhow, there's a change there. Sorry, brain just went. The early part of your question, like making a mistake, the anger. Anger is a healthy thing, or it was given to us as a healthy thing instead of a passion. Healthy anger is like it floods you with energy, and the energy floods you to do a good thing. Like you intervene, someone is hurting a child, and it's a frightening situation, but you leap into it, and you probably leap into it with an anger, and you deal with it, you know? It makes you brave and righteous. That's the anger of the good sort, where Paul will say, be angry, but do not sin. He's talking about that kind of anger. The other anger that gets kind of derived from shame and stuff like that, I tell people, look, if you've been angry for several days, this is not good anger. The other anger is supposed to be short-term, get the job done, and it's over. It's flash. The other, this slow burn, is actually the fire of shame burning in you. That goes on, and it needs to be attended to. And how does it get attended to? Well, confession's a good way to deal with it, for one. And God is very patient about these things. He's slow to anger, but I love that his conversation with Jonah. Jonah's so ticked off because he's gone out there to preach, and God's forgiven the Ninevites when he was promising fire and brimstone, and God just forgave him. Jonah's just angry. God says to him, Jonah, do you do well to be angry? Jonah says, I do well to be angry, angry enough to die. I just love that. What a great answer to God. I mean, he says, these guys are so honest. You know, I do well to be angry, angry enough to die. And God, you know, kind of explains it all to him better. And I think, Jonah, I'm going to put you back in that fish, but till you get your mind right. But Anger can be useful in its right place. It's just so rare to do it that way. And so you have to take care because it can be, you know, very dark and destructive. And when it's shame-driven, you know, there's interesting things, certain, like a desire for justice. Actually, one of the problems with the desire for justice is that it's infinite. It won't ever say it's satisfied. You know, you want to punish. How much punishment? You know, okay, Hitler, 6 million Jews, 1 million years in hell for each one of them. That's still finite. But now I want it infinite. I want him punished like forever and ever and ever. Really, 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 that's justice. And that's a dangerous thing. Cries for justice. The Bolsheviks cried for justice and murdered 60 million. You know? The appetite is never satisfied. That's a dangerous thing. I know when we were having the riots about racial justice, no one was thinking about how to actually change anything, really. They were just angry and wanted to punish and hurt. Abolish the police. Well, that's probably not a good idea, actually. But the anger can't be satisfied. It's to do something extreme. Envy. Envy is when I feel happy about bad things happening to you because you had it coming to you. You know, it's like down in Tennessee. Who do you pull for? Tennessee and whoever's playing Alabama. And it's just how we are. And it's envy. They never lose. It's just not right. You know, they never lose. And Saban is like, will he never die? I mean, it's just all the, of course, the entire SEC is thinking the same thing about him. It's like, please, oh Lord, you know, can he just retire maybe? You know, go fishing on that lake he lives on. But these are dangerous things. They're infinite things, and we don't ever put an end to them. And so they're very, you have to be cautious about them because they become, I think it's possible, this is me theorizing, I don't have anybody else to back me up. This is just pure Father Stephen. I think it's possible to marry yourself to certain things so strongly that they virtually silence the natural will. One example is like cult membership. You can become in a cult sort of so, certain kinds of cult things, so mesmerized by the belief that it becomes the center of your life instead of the natural will. And you silence that. And it's very, very deadly. I think demons try to do this in cases of real possession, which are very rare, but it's sort of to silence that natural will so that the demon becomes the new nature. But it's possible to do that with many things. You can become possessed by a political party or an ideology, and that becomes the raison d'etre of your life, you know, the driving force, and you measure things by it. The Orthodox Church. I run into guys out there on the internet. I had a young man in my parish years back who asked me, where can I get a copy of The Rudder? The Rudder is a book of the canon laws of the church. And I told him, I said, I won't tell you. And he said, why? I said, well, the devil's in that book. I said, I have a copy on my shelf and I almost never take it down. It's for bishops. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, if you start reading The Rudder, the devil will whisper to you. And because it's full of rules, lots of rules. And you'll discover very soon that all priests should not be priests. Like anyway, he got him a copy. And within 3 months of getting a copy, he was attacking me on the internet as a heretic. The chrism wasn't even dry on that guy. And already, I'm an archpriest of the church, and I'm a heretic. You know, blessed by bishops of every jurisdiction to do what I'm doing, and I'm a heretic. He wound up leaving the church, alienated. Actually, he got caught up in the Nazis down south. It got really kind of dark. Well, there's some real dark paths you start down these things. I told him, don't get that book. You don't need to do this. You don't need to read these things. I was serious when I said, the devil is in that. Don't do that. I run into young men out there, and there's places where they, I've heard nicknames, Adam, on there, and forums and question boards and stuff out there, and you get on it, and they will just eat you. Haven't been Orthodox a year, and already they're quoting canon law, and just, they're experts on things, and judging priests, judging bishops, judging metropolitans, judging patriarchs, just out there doing it, just eating it up. And I just think, this is demons. This is not Orthodoxy. This is not who we are. And I try to, there's a canon from the Quinisex Council, Trullo, that says that all canon laws are medicinal. They're all just medicine. They're prescriptions for medicine. But a doctor knows that if you write the same prescription for everybody, you'll kill some. Because the prescription's just the standard, and it has to be changed according to the weight of the patient, according to the conditions like that. Canon laws are the same. Every canon has to be given in a measured form. In fact, if all the canons of the church for ordination of the priesthood were applied, nobody, and I mean nobody, would ever be ordained. Did you know that according to canon law, if a man has engaged in, shall we say, self-abuse, to put it into its like little polite little form, he cannot be ordained. Really? Okay. Okay. I mean, and there's some others out there too, and you just, yeah, got to be over 30. How often does that happen? You know, we need priests more than that. You know, and there's a word for practicing medicine with the canons. It's called economy. We sing glory to thy, and sometimes depending on the translation, we'll sing glory to thy dispensation, O Lord. That's in Greek, that's economia. Glory to thy economia, O Lord. We never pray glory to thy akrivia, O Lord, your strictness. We're only ever, ever, ever saved by God's economy. He's, you know, God slacked up on us. If he was strict, nobody would be saved. And so that's how we apply canon laws. It's not because you're being sloppy or your priest is a liberal. It's because he loves you, and he's a doctor, and he's trying to save your soul. And he's doing the best he can with what he's been given in the canons. As a wise doctor, thinking, well, you just would never give me a strict fasting rule. And it's because I knew you'd be like, you'd be really a jerk if you fasted like that. You know, and you're proving it, you know. No, I won't let, I've told people that when I first wanted to start the Orthodox fast, the man who later became my godfather, Orthodox priest, said, I won't let you. And I said, why? And he gave me several reasons why. So our first year we tried to keep an Orthodox fast, it was 4 years before we converted. He just said, give up red meat, eat chicken and fish, you'll be fine. And I thought, well, that didn't sound exactly Orthodox to me. You know, I was like, I want to fast like the Orthodox. He said, if you want to fast like the Orthodox, then you fast the way your priest tells you. And that's the Orthodox fast. And I thought, oh. Oh. Our Anglican fast says, what are you giving up for Lent? Oh, I don't know, chocolate, you know. Yeah. Well, 1 year in seminary, I decided to give up anger for Lent. It was the hardest fast I've ever kept in my life, especially in a seminary. I mean, golly gee. So there's so many demons there. Gee whiz. Most of them are on the faculty. It was awful. So another question before I get in trouble. Yeah. Yes, please. Yes. You know, and this is a very, it's an awfully good question. I mean, what is the deep heart? I've written about the deep heart and spoken about the deep heart. What is the deep heart? I would say the deep heart, first off, is the deepest part of the heart. I mean, there's like edges of the heart, and then there's deeper, deeper, deeper. The true deep heart, some writers call it the true self, but it's the utter truth of who we are before God. It is the very depth of your being. I would even say that we generally don't know the deep heart. We generally kind of, at most, deal with the surface, certain things about it. For one thing, if I got plunged all the way into my deep heart immediately, say upon being chrismated or something, it would not be good for me. Either too much dazzled by the splendor or too much disheartened by all the filth I had to go through to get there. And I remember a man that God once gave him a vision of his sins. And he said it lasted all day. And he said it's the hardest thing he had ever seen. And eventually he was crying and saying, God, take it away. It's too much. You know. And so Father Zacharias of Essex, when he writes and talks about bearing a little shame, it's very much the stresses on a little. It's something we do a little bit at a time. You're not ready to do that. So I want to, the deep heart is a journey we make, you know. I think in, say, the life and story of St. Peter, he doesn't get there until his last day. He had all that issues with Jesus and off and on and bragging and then denying, then being restored and all that sort of stuff, you know, after the resurrection. But he's in Rome as a bishop of Rome, leader of the church in Rome, and the persecutions under Nero break out and he's running away again. He's running away. And the story is that he meets Jesus as he's leaving Rome. And he says to him, Quo vadis? Where are you going? Jesus says, I'm going to Rome to be crucified again. And Peter returns and goes to Rome and is crucified upside down. Because when they went to crucify him, he begged them to crucify him upside down because he wasn't worthy to be crucified like Christ. I would say that was the day he became Peter. He discovered his deep heart, but he wasn't ready to have it revealed to him until the last day. And it may be that way for us. I don't know, you know, how it goes for us. But it's the journey we make. I pray that as I stand face to face with Christ, that I face him without shame or fear as we pray, and that seeing him face to face, reflected in his face, I will see the deep heart. St. Gregory of Nyssa writes and says, the soul is a mirror, and it's meant to reflect God, but the mirror is dirty. It needs to be polished. And so what we're doing now is polishing so that eventually, when you see the deep heart, you will see Christ. Because you're created in his image. That's a reflection of him. I like to use the image of a fractal. We look like him, only slightly modified. Like him, but me, you know, is Stephen. And so that's the deep heart. I think sometimes, like I talked about hearing your name, when God calls your name, like these disciples, how do you drop everything, leave it, and go for him? You know, Jesus plays games with names, too, in the New Testament. I mean, nicknaming Peter, calling him Rocky Peter. There was something about that Simon just didn't work. Simon just wasn't really who he was. And he probably wasn't very Peter-like either, except in his deep heart. And Jesus looked past Simon, and he named him Peter. You're Peter. And said some things about you as a rock. You know, this was probably everything Peter had ever longed for but never could do. Then you get to Revelation, and it says, you know, about these people who in white robes who've overcome, you know, and are there with him in heaven. And it was given to them a new name, which no man had ever heard. You know, written on a stone, and it's given to them this new name. You know, what's a new name? Your name is your nature. It's kind of renewed, and it's revealed in the image of God. And so there's things sometimes that hint at it. At age 15 in the Episcopal Church, watching the priest in the altar, I first had the thought, that's what I want to be. Nothing had ever spoken to me like that. I wanted to be that. And I forgot about it a few years later, became a Jesus freak, living in a commune, doing that sort of stuff, and pretty much cursing the institutional church. It's a bunch of hypocrites and, you know, all that sort of stuff, a bunch of bourgeois Babylonians and all this kind of stuff. You know? And I was judgmental. And they had it coming to them. And so but I wound up leaving that, and I came back to the institutional church. But I was in college, and I had planned I was going to do a doctorate in classics and teach college. That was my life. I was going to go to an Ivy League place for my doctoral work and do that stuff. I had it all planned out. And I'm riding along in the car one day with my best friend in my senior year of college with my best friend, my commune buddy. Man, we were close. And I'm just chatting away, telling about my life that I'm planning on. I was going to go to Princeton. I'm going to do this stuff and all that and da-da-da-da-da. And he just said, like only a best friend can, he goes, well, Steve, that's, what do you really want to do? What do you want? What do you really want to do? And I don't know what he meant by the question, much less why he asked me that when I thought I was just telling him about what I wanted to do. But when he said it, I shut up. And I was quiet for a few moments. Then I said to him, I really want to be a priest. And that was really, that did it. And I tried to live with that for about a week or so. Then I wound up sitting in the priest's office at church and talking to him that I wanted to go to seminary. And he said, listen to me. He said, well, I tell you what, you go do your doctorate in classics. He said, you can always go to seminary. I thought, good. So I went back, and as I'd pray and studying and doing stuff like that, and the seminary thought would come to me, and I'd say, no, no, the priest said, go to Princeton, do my doctorate. I won't do that. And later, God. And after about 2 weeks, I went to see my priest, and I said, it's not working. So what do you mean? I said, I can't even study. I can't read. It's all I can think about. He said, good, I just wanted to see if you were serious. And he sent me to this other priest to talk to who was connected with the bishop and all of that, and I started the process. I met with the other priest. He said, you need to look at seminaries. I said, good. He goes, no, today. Hands me this stack of catalogs from schools. And anyway, that's what I wound up doing. What happened to me at 15 was probably a first awakening of my deep heart. It was very easy to silence then. And as a lot of things could have, if the other road had been a lot easier and stuff, I might have not even picked it up again. But somehow or another, God spoke through my best friend. And I don't know, it just cut through all the way. And when I said it, it got out there. And I never had any questions about it. It's funny, the bishop who sent me to seminary wanted me to do seminary, but then do a doctorate and teach. So I was supposed to be trained to do theology. And when my senior year of seminary came around, I went to the bishop and said, I want to go to the parish. And he gave me a blessing to go to the parish with the provision that I would agree that I would eventually go do a doctorate. And so after 8 years, I left my parish and went to Duke to work on a doctorate. And I got to a certain place at Duke and thought, I need to go to the parish again. And I turned my doctoral work into an MA on Iconist theology and went back to the parish. God sent me to Oak Ridge, not for an Episcopal parish, but so that I would become Orthodox. Actually, the day I defended my thesis at Duke on the theology of icons, Stanley Hauerwas, who's supposedly, according to Time magazine, is America's greatest theologian, he was on my committee, and Stanley grilled me about it. And he said, do you think the veneration of icons is necessary to salvation? And he knew what he was doing, because an Episcopal priest takes a vow that he believes the scriptures of the Old and New Testaments to contain all things necessary to salvation. He asked me the question, and I couldn't quite give the answer that I was supposed to give, by my training. And I said to him, well, I know what my ordination vow says. I said, but I think the veneration of icons is necessary to its fullness. And later, talking to an Orthodox priest, he said to me, that was a very Orthodox answer. You don't have to venerate icons, but if you want everything God has for you, you will. The next morning, I knelt beside my bed at a friend's apartment in Durham, and I prayed, oh God, make me Orthodox. I mean, Stanley broke my heart the day before, and I suddenly realized that my ordination vows had crumbled. Not that I didn't believe in my priesthood, but that I knew that it wasn't the fullness. It wasn't everything he had called me to. And I prayed, Lord, make me Orthodox. And I meant two things by that. One was, I want to be Orthodox. The other one was, you're going to have to make me. And it was 7 years from then that I was received into the church, and there were heel marks all the way. 3 years before we entered the church, we're laying in bed, my wife and I, one night, and I talked about this every day, all days, about, you know, at home, we talked about this. And I said to her, you know, sweetie, I said, I appreciate your support. I said, but if you're just doing this out of one of those submission to my husband things, you know, and like, I just want to support my husband, you know, and it's just me, I said, I really need to know this, because if it's just me, I can't do this. I just can't do this by myself. She said to me with a wonderful level of wifely disgust, she said, Stephen, we can't do this soon enough. And I thought, oh no, it's just me who's standing in the way. It is just me. And it's like, I don't care if we're digging ditches. We need to do this. Let's get this thing done. I mean, God got it done, but it's funny how these ways work. And these were, and each time they were like little deep heart things, a word, and a word or a question asked, and that question had a way of just pulling back a curtain, and you seeing something about the truth of yourself, and you don't even know how you would get there from here. I mean, I had 4 kids and a mortgage, you know, and a career, and all of that, which at that time in the Diocese of the South, priests were worker priests in storefronts. And I thought I would be living in a trailer in a storefront, and that was pretty much going to be my future. And that was kind of not attractive. As it was, I didn't get to do that. God paid off my house and did a bunch of things for me that I could never have asked for, just things that happened and opened up the gates and took care of us. But, you know, so the deep heart, you know, when has God spoken to you in ways that seem to call you towards Him and towards yourself? They're not common. They're rare. You know, they're rare. But I've seen people have this like in the middle of a liturgy. It's not just any liturgy, but it was like the liturgy of all liturgies. And suddenly the coin drops. You know, and why then? Why that? It's just, there it is. You know, it's sort of, well, I love asking people about their stories of how did you get here? You know, because what a collection of, you know, of drug heels and of odd things. What's God doing? I don't know. Right now, the Orthodox Church in America is just exploding with young people coming in. You know, from where? You know, there's articles in the spring edition of The Word, and articles speculating and giving credit to a lot of us internet blogger types. And I'm thinking, well, I wish it was that easy. I don't know. I don't know where they're coming from. You know, I've got guesses and thoughts, but I just think it's God speaking to the deep heart. And they sometimes come in confused, a lot of weird ideas. Some of them want to read the rudder, you know, whatever. We have to work on them, clean them up, and try to get them pointed. But anyway, that's a long, I only give long answers. I'm so sorry. Yes. Well, briefly, it's like you're just any human being. You don't see a human being if you don't love them. Human beings are persons. Persons can only be perceived through love. If you're not perceiving them through love, then you see them as an object. Only think about Jesus after the resurrection. Mary Magdalene is weeping at the tomb. She thinks he's the gardener. And what does he say to her? Mary. Jesus spoke her name, and her deep heart awakens, the love awakens, and she sees him. And all of these instances of the resurrection, it's interesting. I would say that one of the nature of the resurrection body is it cannot be perceived except by love. You could see it as the gardener or as something, but not as who he is. It's not Jesus. God is not objective. God is not an object, neither is he subjective. He's not just a feeling inside you. God is personal, and he has to be known as person. And that is something that only love can do. What an icon does, the fathers teach that an icon is they call it a hypostatic representation. That is a representation of the person. What is present in the icon is not the substance of the person. I mean, it's wooden paint, right? But the person, the prosopa, the person is present in that. And so it is a personal thing. And we got just some interesting icon stories out there. You know, I tell people when they're new to the church, I'd get you an icon of Christ, an icon of the Mother of God, and maybe your guardian saint. And just do that. Start with that. I mean, most people can't control themselves and they buy a whole like room full of icons and stack them up like that. But what's fun is if you just start with a few, they'll start finding you. Icons will come to you. Someone will give you one, other things. I've got stories, things happen, and you know, and it's just I love those icons, the ones that just come to me. I treasure them more than any others. Sometimes they come to me and I don't know why. And it's not till later that I find out the story as to why I got that icon. And I just assume when it comes to me, the saint wants me to know them. And this is like the opening of a person. Let me introduce you to my pal, you know, Spiridon here. He's got a funny basket on his head and his shoes wear out. But Spiridon, I mean, whoever. That's, you know, we really only see them if we venerate. And how sweet of you to have remembered that. It was actually a real key part of my thesis, that you cannot see them without veneration. This is sort of, I was talking about this, I made this little child-size icon stand, so they start with that. The children learn this, but I think about this, where else in their little lives do they get, in their week, do they get exposed to beauty, and are they taught to venerate anything, to give honor to that where honor is due? They're instead taught to honor sports figures, rock and roll people, TikTokers, other things oftentimes that are really quite shameful and not worth honor at all. And little wonder they turn out weird with that. They need, you know, this other exposure to learn beauty. We have a very... if a beautiful country we live in, we have an extremely ugly culture. I mean, suburban America is like, how many things can you do with asphalt and cement? It's just ugly. Knoxville, where I live in the 1920s, was given an award as the ugliest town in America. They have yet to live it down. And, you know, it's just, oh, what a great place to live. But it is, you know, ugly town. Ugly town, Tennessee. So, but I mean, it reflects us. I mean, why do our cities look so ugly? Because they're built by people who only build for money. Why is it that little beautiful villages in Europe, even times just built by peasants, look so beautiful? Because they actually were building them for a different reason. And it was like that reason is still reflected in this beauty. I mean, in Europe, the average town, the most beautiful place in town is the church. Whether it's a Gothic cathedral or, you know, an Orthodox church with icons and stuff. What are the three biggest buildings in an American city? Banks, hospitals, insurance companies. That's who build the buildings. Pretty much all three are trying to keep us from dying or built on the fear of death, you know, not on the love of beauty. Not on the love of beauty, you know, and not our suburbs. I mean, it's awful. We build these suburbs and the houses, you know, it just doesn't work. We've got this new little apartment thing as I'm coming into Oak Ridge, and they all look exactly alike, and they all look ugly, and they're spread out. There's no trees. They're just on red clay, and they're just there. And there's a housing boom going on, and the prices are through the roof, and people are paying, you know, ridiculous amounts of money to live in that little ugly little thing. And I think, how much more would it have cost to even made that remotely pretty? I mean, it's not that hard. But you have to want to. But if you've got a builder who's only thinking about maximizing profit, and you just are living in his bottom line, and he doesn't care, that ugly makes people ugly. It corrupts the soul. It's not good for us. The soul needs beauty. Interestingly, Plato, when he was writing his Republic, his ideal Republic, said children have to be taught music, all of them. His reason? for the nurture of the soul. You know, what's the first thing they want to cut when the budget gets tight for local schools? Art, music. Take the beauty out. Give them math. Men get weird. Give them new math so they'll never know what the heck is going on. You know, oh my goodness. So, another question, or call time, one or the other. One last question, then they'll pronounce me dead. That's okay. Oh, come on, even I get a time limit. Oh, no, come on, come on. Yes, sir. Yes, Father. Yeah. Right.
I said, well, this is probably not going to happen in my watch. And then the woman kind of went away very sad, so to speak. What would be a good answer to ask women?
Yeah. How many men here are priests? You got one, two, three. Only one of them serves here. Only one guy. They say, why don't they ordain women? I'm thinking, we got a guy. We only ordain one of them. I tell people it's not about, I mean, there is a gender aspect to priesthood in that the priest functions as an icon of Christ. Christ became man. He became a male. And you don't paint the icon of Christ as a woman. You just don't. We don't paint the icon of Christ as a male. And part of that is saying, you know, and people get weird about it in our culture, but it's like, you know, we take icons seriously. You don't distort Christ. It is what it is. And so the priest does that. He's imaging that. Are women not icons of Christ? Of course they're icons of Christ, but they're figured in a different way. The St. Maximus described gender as an energy of the human. It's a way of organizing it. Woman is a way of organizing the human energy. Male is a way of organizing the human energy. And it's just how it is in the church. But how about all the rest of you? You know, male, female, you have many roles to play. There's this one, and that's just one role in the church. I think part of it is, as we've begun to think in economic terms, and we define ourselves, I am my job. How can I have the best job? How can I have the big job? How can I have the lead job? And I want to define myself by that. We're just thinking all kinds of weird things. I mean, when I was becoming Orthodox, the priest, our missions director, was meeting with my wife and I in our home, my wife and me, and he said to my wife, he said, your role, this is new, he said, your role in the church is to be the Theotokos. And that was weird. And it took us some years to figure out what that meant. But my wife is a reflection of the Mother of God. She embodies that in some incredible ways in the life of our congregation. We're Southerners, and so we quit calling her Matryoshka. That's just kind of weird. And so and Presbytera is not ever an OCA thing and all these others. She's Mother Beth, and that fits just real well. I mean, they didn't call her Mama or anything, but just Mother Beth. And it's just sort of how it is. Our godmother's name was Mother Terry. She was married to Father Peter, but Mother Terry. And so she became Mother Beth. But she's just mother in that. And she's mother like, I mean, my daughters, my son, there's these things in my family that they will ask her that they don't ask me, especially if they want a short answer. But, you know, so, and you know, it's like, what does God want to do with your life? The idea of thinking that standing at the altar is somehow the thing to do in the church is just, boy, believe me, from the perspective of someone who stands there, it's not what you think it is. It is the cross. I want to get crucified. I think, oh, yeah, you do. It looks so cool. Yeah, I think the vestments are neat. I will give you that. The vestments are really, really neat. but you know, I love the, but you know, but they're bloody, and you know, you, what do you want to do? I love what Mother Teresa used to say. I want to do something beautiful for God. How well that's put. I want to do something beautiful for God. If you're doing it for Him and you're not doing it for yourself, why are you so worried what it is? You know, I want to give God a gift. Well, give, especially give Him what He wants. Give Him you. Give Him something like that. But these other things is like, I would like to look at myself as a priest. In seminary, this is a common disease. Men who are dealing with their shame by seeking the priesthood. Oh, it covers you up. It's not. It's wonderful to be shouted axios, you know, but at some point you got to get over it, because you don't get over it, it'll destroy your soul. And I've seen guys who've eaten it. They've eaten them. It's tragic, but it's a temptation for every priest, in many, many ways. You know, to avoid the cross of it. So, good questions, Father. But the first part of it, you said something about Father Hopkins' maxims. So the reason I've not done anything like that is I couldn't imagine on how to improve on them. I mean, I just push them, you know, read them, do them, Xerox them, put them on your fridge, put them on your, you know, put it over your computer screen, whatever. I think they're about as good a description of the Christian life as I've seen. They weren't originally 55. I think they were 40, you know, and then he added 15. You know, if he'd lived this long, maybe he'd have added another 20, but I couldn't think of what they would be. So thank you all, and let's have somebody bless us out of here.